You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 305.
On today's show, we talk about extinct animal images in rock art, an 8,000-year-old figurine, and using AI to find more Nazca lines.
Let's dig a little deeper. I'm only going to use AI to dig from now on. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello. This feels so weird right now. I don't even know what to do. I guess we have to give some context to that sentence.
Yes. So yeah. Rachel and I are not in the same location. We're recording on the software that the rest of the APN uses, but we never do.
Yeah, we're recording the way everybody else normally does. And we turned our video on so we can still see each other and interact with each other and play off of each other's faces. So when I give him like the eye roll or the make your Roman joke eyes like I did in the last episode, he'll still be able to see
them. Couples out there, your Roman joke eyes. Yes.
Oh, you'll have to go back and listen to the other episode if you want to know what I'm talking about.
What has your wife ever done for you? That's, I mean, the Romans. What have the Romans? Yes. We've got a news episode for you today. And Yes. There was, I don't know, the theme. There were mysteries, I guess, a little bit, but not really. Everything in archaeology is a mystery until you dig it up and talk about it.
I would almost say it's like kind of artistic mysteries a little bit, because there's a lot of examples of art in the archaeological record, but we don't always know what they were doing with it or why they created it, what the purpose was or whatever. And these three articles are examples of different types of art and how there are new-ish interpretations of it, or maybe some of the interpretations might be a bit of a reach depending on your perspective. Yeah, we'll talk about it though.
Yeah. So this first one is titled "Archaeologists Uncovered a Painting That May Prove the Existence of a Mysterious Creature." Now, painting, it's really rock art. We'll call it a painting. It's not like they uncovered an oil or something like that.
Or I guess it is, but Was anyway. It a pictograph or a petroglyph?
Yes.
And there's a difference between those. Yes. You want to explain that just like really quick? I know we've covered this before, but
yeah, pictographs are just paints of various types, whatever kind of paint that they just use on a surface without altering the surface necessarily. And a petroglyph is an altered surface. So pecs or carvings or scratches or something like that. Now, interestingly, you can have a petroglyph that has been painted. It's still at its base level, a petroglyph that has been painted. So it's not a pictograph, right? A pictograph is something that just has been painted, right? Murals, things like that. But this, I believe, is a pictograph. It doesn't really say, although some of the, I guess, dating methods and things like that, and they just keep saying painting within the article. So they never really go into it.
Yeah, they don't. But just to jump right into it, it is 200 years old as opposed to significantly older, which is what many examples of rock art are. And so I feel like 200 years ago, painted in the early 1800s, it could be a painting. That would make sense.
Yeah. People were doing other things back then too. This, whatever, this is just,
like human development though, or whatever. This is only 200 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's in South Africa and it depicts a horned serpent like creature, which what they're saying in this article is that it possibly represents an extinct animal.
Yes.
And this was a little confusing to me. The word they use is a new extinct animal, but I think, I'm not sure it's necessarily, I think it was new to the people who drew the art, if that makes sense, because the extinct animal that they're talking about was not described until like later. So this would have been new to that time, to those people. Does that make sense? Am I saying that okay? Okay.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. No, I don't know that it actually was new to the people who painted it, the people who depicted it, new to researchers.
It was, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems to be a depiction of what the researchers are calling a dicynodont or dicynodont. D-I-C-Y is the first part there. So I think it's dicynodont.
Yeah, my brain said that. Yeah, I was saying dicynodont, but dicynodont.
Dicynodont, like, yeah, that could be right.
Yeah.
And that's a tusked herbivorous reptile, which sounds, I mean, I'm imagining like something like a huge python with tusks. And I'm like, that's terrifying.
I honestly have no idea how to even envision that.
Yes.
And speaking of envisioning it, don't try to look at the article to get an envisionment. Yes, that's a word. Because they're just using Getty. This is a Popular Mechanics article, and sometimes these articles really annoy me because they get real lazy with their images sometimes, and they just pulled in. God, you again. Quit finding Popular Mechanics articles.
They're supposed to be popular, so I figured people must like them.
Not everybody who's popular is good. Anyway, so the image that they put at the top of the article is not rock art. And it's stock not of footage. The fossil either. It's just like a stock Getty image of some random assembled fossil of some sort, fossil dinosaur thing. So anyway, don't go get information from that image. But anyway, I really can't envision what this thing looked like, though. It sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah. This horned serpent lived before the dinosaurs. Yes. So it's not the San people have actually seen one of these, but it is in their San rituals. It's in their like mythical rituals, like their mythology, so to speak, is this serpent. Now, that is not uncommon, right? Because this animal was first described in Science in, what was it, 1845, I believe, because fossils have been found.
Like a decade after this picture, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and fossils have found all over the what's called the Karoo Basin in South Africa of this horned serpent. So it lived all over this area 65 plus million years ago, because we're talking before dinosaurs. So we're talking 200 plus million years ago, probably. They don't actually, I think, put a date on that. It just says pre-dinosaurs, which would have been a long time ago.
Right.
So if these fossils are eroding out and these people would have seen these fossils and seen them as bones of something, they don't know how long ago this thing lived. It could have lived yesterday, as far as they know.
Yeah, so they could have no might idea. Expect to see one around the corner, right? They might be.
Yeah, who knows?
They might have seen this bone eroding or the skeleton eroding out of the side of a cliff and think, oh, man, because I'm hiking around here, I got to watch out for these guys. Yeah.
And the San people are known in their cultural practices for incorporating elements of their environment, including fossils, into their art and mythology. It's part of what right? They've done a lot of this stuff in different things. And one of the things, one of their cultural practices is rainmaking ceremonies. It's South Africa. You don't get a lot of rain, right? When they want rain, one of the things in their rainmaking practices was this horned serpent. And it may have been used in some of their rainmaking rituals, symbolizing a rain animal, so to speak, to invoke rainfall. So to invoke different ritualistic things, ritualistic behavior, not invoke ritual, to be part of ritualistic behavior. And if they're trying to invoke rainfall, this rock art could have been a part of that. So it makes sense. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, this whole thing is so interesting because, like we said, the painting predates the formal scientific description of dicynodonts by at least a decade. And so what they're saying is that the San people, through their probably just knowledge of the area, their religious ceremonies that are maybe using the items that they're finding on the landscape, which could include these fossils, through all of that, maybe they would go hunting for these fossils, right? And they'd be looking for them on purpose. Maybe it was something that was important to some ritual or whatever. We don't know. And maybe they were doing something that could be almost considered paleontology.
It's a leap. I know. The article,
a leap. Okay. Go for it. It's a leap.
So the ology part of paleontology is the study of, right? I don't think the San people were necessarily studying these fossils. They were definitely incorporating the concept of this ancient creature into their own mythology, their own cultural practices, but they certainly weren't trying to study this ancient creature. So I think calling it indigenous paleontology, like the article is suggesting, is a little bit of a stretch.
I fully agree.
give it to the San for using it in their rock art, but weren't trying to do some sort of scientific research, right?
Yes, I agree they weren't trying to do research. I will maybe push back just a little bit, because now I'm not a paleontologist, obviously, but when you're finding a fossil, you don't just stumble across a perfectly articulated fossilized skeleton. Usually it's not often in pieces. Jurassic Park. Exactly. So it's like in pieces that you have to chip out of the stone or mm-hmm. whatever. Or if it's like in like a riverbed or something, like the ones in Jurassic Park, where they're where it's actually articulated and buried, and they uncover one part of it and then they follow the whole thing down. So if they did uncover a small piece of it sticking out and then they started traveling along following the rest of it, carefully uncovering it so that they saw the full shape, because how else would they know what the full shape of the animal would have looked like in order to paint it on the cave walls? So if they mm-hmm. carefully uncovered a fossilized skeleton to learn the shape that they then painted on the walls, would you call that paleontology? They are carefully chipping stone out of the way to identify the shape of the thing.
Yeah, but they're not learning from it. They're not documenting it. They're not trying to, I don't know. I wouldn't call the excavation of it learning. You have to learn. You have to learn from it and then interpret it and then do things with that knowledge. It's a little bit of a stretch.
It is a stretch. But my brain is like firing right now, because I'm also like, were they learning in the way they know how to learn, and were they sharing that knowledge in the way they knew how? You're rolling your eyes so hard at me right now.
Okay, like, sure.
They learned from it and then they shared that with the people in their society.
I'm not going to win this one.
Learn and share knowledge. You are going to win. I still agree. I think it's a stretch, but
they were paleontologists
within the, they were not paleontologists in the modern definition of that word, obviously. And, but it would have taken an interesting mind of an indigenous person to go down that path and find mm-hmm. the full skeleton, to figure out the shape, to do the drawing and all of that kind of stuff. Or sure. get really lucky and find one easily identifiable. But
yeah. I mean, it sounds like there were lots of them and they could have probably pieced it together. And I don't know what the fossil remains look like down there, because sometimes in certain contexts, especially sandstone and things like that, sometimes you do find relatively fully intact fossil forms. Yeah, it just depends on. Depends on how old it is, and depends on how stable the rock formations were when they were forming and things like that. If there hasn't been a lot of plate movement and things like that, they don't get crushed over time and moved. And there are a lot of factors. So they could be just eroding out of the ground relatively intact and in shape. Yeah. Hard to say.
Yeah.
Just quickly before we take a break here, the San are an indigenous group of hunter-gatherers from South Africa, as we mentioned, and they are considered one of the oldest cultures on Earth. Mm-hmm. They have been around for a really long time. And historically, they did live in small nomadic groups and have had, obviously, a deep connection to the land and its resources as a result, because of where they live, how they travel.
Yeah.
Their lifestyle has always included hunting game, gathering wild plants, and they've always possessed an extensive knowledge of the environment, because you have to in that sort of place.
Yeah, sure. And they are obviously a very spiritual group too, and their spirituality would often involve trances, rituals, belief in powerful supernatural beings, and rock art, like we talked about, could play a significant role in this type of stuff that they're doing. Yeah. It's interesting because, again, I feel like most rock art is typically thought to be older, at least in this country, although that's not necessarily true either. So I'll take that statement back. But in this case, it is only 200 years old. So the people who drew those images on the wall, they might have living ancestors today that could almost have oral histories that go back to what the source of that rock art was, or what the reason for that rock art was. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're willing to communicate it with us or researchers, but it's not that long ago. Not really. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break and find out what story an 8,000-year-old figurine in a cave can tell us. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 305 of the Archaeology Show. And now we are going to talk about another article here with a figure from Azerbaijan, a sandstone figurine. The article is called "Scientists Found an 8,000-year-old figurine in a cave. Its engravings tell the story of an ancient culture." 8,000 years old, though. That is something.
Old. That is real old. And
real old.
Yeah. You might think that you could go to this article and see what an 8,000-year-old figurine looks like and You would, in fact, be wrong about that, because this is another Popular Mechanics article with a Getty image at the top of it. I feel like we're always like throwing shade on these articles that have bad stuff in them, you know, where they just didn't do a good job. And you might think that we should just like not talk about them. But also, I feel like it's important to like point this stuff out to people.
Well, I just want to interrupt because,
okay,
yes, it's got a Getty image, but there's also an open access link to the actual article from Science Direct. So if you click on the word published in the first like paragraph or something, you can literally see all of it. So do that. And you can download the PDF even. So
Yeah. It's just, I just don't understand why they couldn't take the time to drop that image in, because the image that they put up there is very confusing. It's like a headless bust from like Greece or something like that. And I'm like, no, that doesn't fit this article at all. So anyway,
it's kind of weird.
But it's just a warning. You always have to vet these articles, because the people writing the articles, the places publishing the articles, they don't always do a very good job. So you really can't take what you're seeing at face value. You need to double check.
That's why this show exists.
That is. It's our
job. That's why we do
articles. That's why we're doing it. But at the same time, we really like the content of this article. So we felt like it was worth talking about. So what do those mechanics have to say?
Well, what have mechanics ever done for us? Honestly,
they
though,
given us this, a lot of content.
Listen, this is why this the archaeology show. To take a little bit of an aside here, this is why we're not like necessarily linking to Science Direct articles and looking at journal articles and stuff like that. I mean, I specifically wanted to talk about a Popular Mechanics article and the Daily Mail and stuff like that, because that's what you guys are being exposed to, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about these things.
We're exposed to. Yeah.
Well, it's what everybody's exposed to, right? And that's, you know, this is what the world is being shown as archaeological, you know, knowledge. And I want to talk about these things. So,
Anyway. And I do. Yeah. I hate that they didn't put any effort into choosing a better image, though. It's just really frustrating to me. You know, like, I just don't understand why, but they did a bad job. So that's okay. We're here to correct it. Because you have to go look at the figurine in that article. We'll put the link to the actual open access article separate so that you can just go directly to that. He's so cute. He's like this little like Weeble Wobble kind of. He looks like a little bit taller and skinnier than a Weeble Wobble, if anybody gets that reference. If you're, you know, if you're born in the 80s or earlier, you probably get it. But anyway.
Yeah. It's kind of neat.
Okay. So super cute little figurine, right? And this is at the Mesolithic Neolithic transition period. It was gradual and it varied regionally, just generally speaking about how that happened. And the Neolithic
period, they knew they were transitioning.
Right. It's so funny because we totally apply these words to them after the fact. And that's just how it goes when you're a researcher looking back at people who did not leave words behind to tell us what they thought of themselves.
But they're like, man, you know, looking across the street and be like, man, those guys are still in the Mesolithic. I wish they would just join us in the Neolithic already.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. That would actually be a really funny like comic or something.
Like, I mean, I feel like it's like Gen Z and Gen X or something like that. It's like, let's just.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my God.
Anyway. So this article is saying that this is the oldest piece of art ever found. It's a small sandstone figurine of a human. And it dates to, of course, the Mesolithic area.
Era.
The Mesolithic era.
Yes.
Now I got to leave that in because you laughed over it.
That Mesolithic area over there. Not that Neolithic area.
I'm
going to
leave all this in because you're making fun of me.
But that Mesolithic area. We don't want to leave that area out.
All right. That's enough. Moving on.
So the Mesolithic area that it was found in was Demjili Cave in modern day Azerbaijan.
You're the worst.
All right. Sorry. It was actually first explored by archaeologists in 1953. Yeah. That's shocking to me. That area has been inhabited by humans for at least 8,000 years, apparently, and it was first explored by archaeologists in 1953.
By archaeologists.
I mean, that, probably by other people. You know,
local people knew about it. Yeah. Local people knew. They knew that there was old stuff in there. They maybe didn't have the full context, but that's always like the whole like Western perspective on archaeology. It's like, we didn't find this till 1953. And it's like, well, no, like, you didn't find it till 1953.
Our next little point here was the cave was used over a long period of time with a high density of Neolithic settlements. I mean, caves are great places to just chill because they're protected. You're out of the elements, you know, so caves are going to be high density places for lots of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this figurine in question, I love this story because it's this is just how it goes with archaeology sometimes. But it was initially almost discarded because it was found amidst a layer of sediment. And I guess I didn't quite understand the geography here, but it's along the bank of the Kura River. So either it was eroding out of the cave or the river is near the cave or somehow the river and the cave are connected. And so that's how they're able to say that this is part of that whole complex that's going on there. But the only reason that they saved it is because somebody noticed these like faint lines drawn on it that were clearly not natural. They had to have been put there by a person. And that's just how it goes sometimes. And if you look at the picture, you'll see why. It's it looks like a very smooth weeble wobble. So it doesn't it looks like a river rock. It really would have just blended right in with something that was natural unless you look at it very closely.
So they used microscopic analysis and they were able to see basically most of the pattern on the shape because it was really hard to see when you're just looking at it. So they really had to kind of analyze it microscopically. But it dates to between 6400 and 6100 BCE, which that must be relative dating because this is a piece of river rock and the rock itself probably dates to, you know, several hundred million years if I had to guess. So they didn't date the rock itself.
Yeah, yes, it must be. And we have notes about the other artifacts that we're finding found in context with it further down. So, oh my gosh, these pictures in the article are so interesting. You really have to go look at them. I'm looking at them right now and it's just the cutest little figure. I just love him so much. Or her. You, there's no gender. I can't assign pronouns though. I won't do that.
Well, them. They specifically said, so I don't know if you're genderizing the little Weeble Wobble itself, but the figure on the Weeble Wobble, we're not going to call it a Weeble Wobble, unit 5.2. is what they called it, was not actually gender specific. There are no gender identifying markings on it. Yeah. So
there's not. So really, we don't know.
Right. There were some substances on the surface of it. Now I'm seeing in the article here, in the actual journal article, in the cracks and things of it, some a black substance that they looked at, they saw on there. No other really identifiable materials, but they were able to use XRF analysis, which is, what is it?
X-ray portable
XRF. X-ray fluorescence. Yeah, wow. That was truly escaping me. And that was probably one of the ways they were able to just determine some of the pigments that were on there. But that had a high iron content, is what they said.
Yeah.
So they're just kind of, you know, analyzing some of the things on there.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. Yeah, anyway. They thought there might have been like red pigment involved somehow, which adds just another layer to the art of it all. You know, like you've got an engraved stone, which is cool and awesome. Anybody can pick up a stone and etch some lines into it, right? But then when you take that next step and bring in a pigment of some sort and start putting color on some areas and or all of it or however you do it, then that's just like a whole other step in the art process. So it's even more complicated, more complex. Very interesting. So size-wise, just to get some context here, it is 2 inches long, half an inch wide, and about a third of an inch thick. So really not very big.
No.
And one of the sides has much more complicated engravings and the other has less so, which they, you know, speculate that the more complicated side would have been the front of it.
Right. Yeah. There are no facial features. Lower body has less decoration, but there are three vertical horizontal lines, likely representing a belt or piece of clothing, like a loincloth or apron or something like that. But yeah, aside from that, no other real features or anything like that.
There's also hair at the top. There's this explicitly delineated horizontal line across. So if you look at the pictures, you'll see these like line drawings. There's this delineated, really sharp horizontal line at the top that could be hair or it could be a hair band or the edge of a cap or something going on there. It looks to me like somebody with sharp bangs cut across their face, basically. That's how it looks. That's not necessarily what they meant for it to look like, but that's how it looks when you look at the picture of it. So, yeah, really cool.
Yeah. Alongside the figurine, they found remnants of stone fireplaces, bone, flake stones, all kinds of stuff. So anyway, this seems like artistic representation, local tradition of artistic representation is what they said. Mm-hmm. Although there could be cultural influence from Southwest Asia, hard to say.
Yeah.
So, but kind of a neat little look into when you find something artistic like this amongst an assemblage of, I mean, kind of basic things, to be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
basic
yeah.
living type things, which is a lot of what mm-hmm. we find in a site like this. Then you find something that's more artistic and just a little bit, you know, more, I guess, more insight into the people, right?
Yeah.
This is something somebody may have just been sitting around the fire and just kind of carving this just for fun, or maybe carving it for a, you know, for a gift or for a child, or maybe, I hate to say it, ritual, you know, something like that. But who knows, right? So wait, I'm gonna do that over again in real time. It could have been ritual.
Ritual.
I forgot we were on Zencaster. We have their sounds.
I love it. We can't steal. Okay, so context. That's the ritual sound that Ash and Tilly use in the. And my trial show. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, we have a little soundboard here on.
We can't steal their Zencaster. Sound. We can't steal their
we
sound.
We did, though. We did. We stole it. So, anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really cool. It's nice to see those little humanizing features. I mean, it's humanizing to see the other stuff as well, but when you have that one little extra yeah. aspect of it, it's just, it's very personal. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? The other stuff
it really is.
Doesn't seem as personal. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
I love that little right. personal touch on a site for yeah. sure. It's really so cute. I hope a little kid played with it or something. That's what right. I want for that artifact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we go from something incredibly personal to, you know, your personal artificial intelligence discovering more archaeological truths about the Nazca lines. I don't know.
That doesn't artificial make any sense.
Well, AI is kind of personal because it's like you're creating another intelligence to do your work for you. So, yeah.
Okay.
I see it. Are you giving me Roman eyes?
These are my skeptical yes. eyes.
What else has AI done for you? All right. Back in a minute. Welcome back to segment 3 of the Archaeology Show, episode 305. And we're going to talk about AI now in segment 3, and this article is called How We're About to Solve the World's Greatest Archaeological Puzzle. I don't know about that. It is a pretty good puzzle, though. So
it is. It's true. And it is a great example of how AI can help in
yes.
filling in the picture of all of the ancient world.
Yes. Although, maybe I'll save this because I have some criticism because, okay. you know, we'll get into yeah. it, though. Although,
yeah.
maybe not now that I'm actually saying that out loud because I was thinking about this, but let's get into it. So let's talk about
okay.
this. First off,
yeah.
the Nazca lines, N-A-Z-C-A, if you've somehow never heard of that before, but the Nazca
never
lines
seen it spelled, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess they're ancient yeah. geoglyphs, and geoglyphs in archaeological terms are basically any feature, I guess we would call them. They're not really artifacts, but features are immovable in archaeological mm-hmm. parlance typically, but right. they're made of rocks. So big, huge things made of rocks, technically.
Like
yeah.
a part of Shapes. The landscape that you can't move without great effort, you know?
Right. Now,
yeah,
it's hard to say what you're going to call a geoglyph sometimes, because when I said made of rocks, you might think, well, are the pyramids geoglyphs? And I'd be like, are the right. pyramids geoglyphs? Well, they're buildings.
No, but, the word glyph changes that, because like,
yeah,
like petroglyph and like that's coming. That's somehow related to the art piece of it.
Because I think the glyph, well, I think glyph implies more of an image.
Image,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
it's more image. Of an image. So mm-hmm. when you think geoglyph, something. Think image or shape and not something that has really any other function, right? So mm-hmm. while it might have a function from a meaning standpoint, but it doesn't have a function from a, you know, like the pyramids you can go inside of, right?
Yeah.
Well,
they had a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a purpose. You can go inside, you can do something. So it's more of a structure, whereas mm-hmm. a glyph is more of a shape. So anyway, not to yeah. get bogged down that too much, but these
and
are located on the
yeah. pretty large, right? Is
well,
size a factor here?
No.
Oh yeah, I guess
yeah.
they don't really have to be. Okay.
Yeah, they
right.
can be small. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the,
these are large.
Well, these are large, yes.
Yes.
Which will factor in later into their potential meanings. But yeah, they're located on the plains south of Lima, Peru. And they were created by the Nazca people between 200 BC and 650 AD. And Rachel, I'm sure you've been there before since you've been to Peru 900 times. Have you not seen the Nazca lines?
I have not. Oh, I'm so mad that I haven't.
Why did you not go there?
Because no, it's just not the area that I was working in. Hmm. So I worked in the northern part of Peru when I was there, the three times that I went. And well, of course, I could have left and gone other places. It's just I was there for working primarily and then for fun. And I just didn't have time to go there. So
now you and I know probably some others, you guys did go to like Machu Picchu at least once. Mm-hmm. Did anybody take like a side trip that you know of to go see the Nazca lines? Was it challenging to do that? I'm just curious from where you were.
I don't know. Nobody that I was there with did, or at least they didn't tell me about it if they did. Yeah. So I don't know. No, I don't know.
Because to really see them, I mean, you could walk the Nazca lines. We'll talk about that maybe. But to really see them, you got to see them from the air.
You have to.
Yeah. Because these geoglyphs, these Nazca lines cover, they're not just like one thing. There's lots of them. And you can see they cover about 175 square miles of desert. Yeah, so there's a lot of area there.
A lot of area, and they're gigantic. And yeah, you really can only see them from the air. You can only see the full shape of them from the air, you know?
Right. Yeah, they depict people, animals, plants, tools, sort of. And they somewhat mystified archaeologists and everyone else really for over a century. That,
you know, note, I don't like being described as mystified.
Well, mystified in the sense that we don't really know why they were created, right? Mm-hmm. We never really will, because we can't get in the minds of the people who did it. But we don't really know what a lot of things that we see were created for. I mean, I guess that's not necessarily true. We know why projectile points were created. We know why structures were created. We know why pottery was created. But we don't know why a lot of designs on certain things were done in the way they were done. We never will. It was artistic in a lot of cases. But we don't know why they chose to do something one way versus another. We don't know why they used a horned serpent in a certain, you know, petroglyph versus another one.
Why they prefer one house shape over another house shape. Those are the kind of stylistic design choices, preferences, whatever you want to call it, that it's really hard to use the archaeological record to interpret. Like, that's just really hard to do. And something like this, which doesn't really have a purpose that we know of, it's almost impossible to know what they used it for.
Well, and we're never going to probably know why somebody decided that, hey, when I take this top layer of brown dirt from the surface here in the desert and reveal the light colored clay and lime beneath in Peru, I can see it really well, like from a distance. Mm-hmm. And if I just do this over a kind of a larger scale here. Well, first off, they probably realized you could do that and make a shape, but who decided to make them so big?
Gigantic.
Like gigantic, you know, it had to have been some sort of, there had to be ritual involved. Like there's no way there wasn't, right?
You wouldn't go and kind of effort without it being ritual.
Well, no. And I have to imagine, and people have probably tried to do this. If we probably did some research, we'd probably see this, but people have probably tried to say, what did the night sky look like 2,000 years ago? Because if you also used AI, we'll get into the AI portion of this in a minute, but if you also used AI to probably try to correlate some of the Nazca line shapes with the star patterns back then and look for those shapes in the stars, because people didn't necessarily see the same constellations we do. Constellations just shapes and patterns in the stars. Mm-hmm. So with a pure dark sky, like we don't necessarily see today, but everybody saw a dark sky 2,000 years ago, they didn't have any light pollution. So, and you have your own interpretations of the world that you live in, you're going to see different shapes. And this might have been their connection with the heavens, so to speak, by just trying to interpret massive shapes in the sky by replicating those shapes on the ground, right? And the bigger they could make them, the bigger their connection. So, I don't know. But anyway,
I love
artificial
that.
Intelligence.
Yes. How is that entering into this picture now?
Right. Well, Professor Masato Sakai from Yamagata University, and they actually have a Nazca center there at this Yamagata University studying these things. But they used AI, and they trained this AI on the current Nazca lines and shapes, which you have to do that to train an AI model, basically.
Yeah.
But it helped them discover...
It has to know what it's looking for, basically.
Yes. Yeah. But it helped them discover 303 more figurative geoglyphs, almost doubling the previous total. And it only took them 6 months to do that.
That is crazy, right?
Yeah. 303 more. Yeah.
I understand AI, that AI is better at crunching data than humans are, obviously. That's why AI is so useful. But we've had airplanes flying over this area for, 70 years or something like that? Why would it...
At least.
Why would human eyeballs miss so many of these that the AI was able to pick up?
I think I think it's just partly that probably, but I think it's also pattern recognition. Like, you know, we jump to more obvious patterns than the AI would, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't see some of the less obvious patterns. And if we train the AI in all the things we know exist and then train it in maybe some of the more cultural things that the Nazca people would have known about and probably had, I'm not sure what they trained it on, but that was some of my criticism that I was thinking about in the beginning was, and I'm sure these people thought about this, so I can't really criticize it too much, but you have to, if you're going to think of the shapes that this thing, you know, that the AI may have been looking for, you have to put yourself into the mind of a Nazca person 2,000 years ago, not a researcher from today, 2025, 2024, really. You know, you can't really do that, because if you did that, well, the AI might find an iPhone drawn on the desert floor.
Right.
Because you might actually find that if you're looking at random shapes.
Yeah, you know? you would be putting your modern bias into the algorithm, which would then skew the entire thing. So I don't know how they would be able to correct for that.
Yeah, because the thing about the Nazca lines is, yes, there are lots of shapes and geoglyphs out there, but interestingly, some have been drawn or created over the tops of others. It's almost like some have been erased and others have been created over the tops of them. And I'm not sure if, you know, weathering was a factor or it's just like destruction and rebuild or, you know, maybe, or who knows what's going on there. And I think that's part of what's going on here is they're trying to see what maybe some of the older ones are or some of the ones that were removed.
Yeah. Now that makes sense, because it would be really hard for human eyes or even like computer eye. Well, maybe computer eyes could be able to do it, but human eyes from an airplane or human eyes looking at a photo taken. All eyes are human, aren't they? Well, wait, no.
No, I'm giving you computer eyes right now. All eyes are human. What? That's like most of the eyes on this planet are not human. I'm just pointing that out. Rachel's losing it right now.
I'm cutting all of
this. I'm not going to get into this too much, and she might delete this, but Rachel had a rough week. Let's just put it that way.
Oh my God, it was so rough. I'm a little delirious right now. Okay. Anyway, so what the point I was trying to get at is these lines laying over the top of each other from past ones and then newer ones on top of them or whatever, like maybe trying to erase, or maybe they just faded and somebody wanted a new one and whatever. So that I could see AI really excelling at picking apart the different lines, which glyph they belong to and which maybe even which are on top or underneath or whatever. So I feel like an AI model would come in really handy with sorting out those overlaying images.
Either way, the lines that they have found and the different shapes and things like that have shown how much planning and measurement was put into by the Nazca people in making these things. I mean, it is just not some haphazard sort of deal that you go into. I mean, these were precision.
They're elaborate, beautiful. I don't understand how they did them, honestly.
Nazca lines. I never thought of that for like a timelines episode. The Nazca lines would be a great one for an anchor.
It'd be a great anchor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I feel like anybody who has like a even a peripheral interest in archaeology and world history can kind of close their eyes and see that image of like that squiggly bird image. You know, that's like the most common one I feel like pops up in the world.
Yep.
Words weren't the word today. Anyway, squiggly bird in the world, that's the most common one. But Yeah, so we'll do that. That sounds like a great one.
So AI is being used all over archaeology right now because patterns are hard.
Yeah.
Going. So AI is being used to identify other archaeological sites, such as hill forts, shipwrecks, and by analyzing aerial and satellite imagery, because let's be honest, pretty much the entire planet has been visualized by satellite imagery and if not aerial imagery, and nobody's looked at it. Like, I mean, a lot of it has not been analyzed. It exists, but it hasn't been looked at. And if you can have AI go out and just look for things that don't look natural, it can at least flag that and say, hey, a human needs to look at this and take a look at it. So, but the use of AI is helping just speed up the discovery process, really, and allowing researchers to analyze really large regions more efficiently and just kind of pinpoint where you need to go.
Yeah, it takes the grunt work out of it, basically, which is really nice because it lets archaeologists do the fun part of this kind of work, which is discovering the things rather than just staring at blank desert spaces that might have a slight line on it and then trying to figure out if that line is actually a line or is it just a weird, you know, geographical thing? Because that happens too. Straight lines do occur in nature. So, like,
Well, I will tell you, our next little point here, though, says AI models are not perfect, but
they're not.
Provide more suggestions for sites with which can be verified by humans. Okay. Mm-hmm. That gets to my next point, though, because I have been saying for, what is it, 2025 right now? I've been saying for almost exactly 10 years this year, because it was 10 years ago this year that I did a project on a Navy base down in California. And on that Navy base was unexploded ordnance. And I talked about it extensively on two other podcasts that I was on, Archaeotech and Sierra Mark podcast. And we had to have unexploded ordnance technicians with us because anything metal, basically, that looked explodey, we weren't allowed to touch, right? I mean, there were some weird bomb-shaped things.
Fair enough. Did you want to touch it?
No. Yeah, and most archaeologists carry like a quiver of pin flags in our backpacks. So when we find something, we're supposed to pin it.
In the West.
You couldn't use... Yeah. In the West, you couldn't use metal pin flags because if you poked metal into the ground and you touched something that was maybe an unexploded bomb, because they used experimental ordnance on this base too, and things were different shapes and sometimes they didn't go off to explode. So we used to use fiber pin flags. And yeah, crazy, right? So I was thinking, because we're out in the desert here, that's mostly flat, except maybe a little bit rolling.
Hilly.
Yeah, I mean, but no trees really. Yeah. And I was thinking, even back then, with drone technology and videos and humans, not even thinking AI at the time, that if we could just do high resolution imagery, you know, low pass above the ground and just take video and have people just look at the video, honestly, and see if they see anything in the video that was feature or even artifact related and just have archaeologists ground truth those discoveries.
Yeah,
it would be better than boots on ground survey. And but AI would take the human element out completely because AI would be able to find patterns and find those things that we would just have to go out and ground truth. And you could do 100% survey versus the 5% survey that we normally do. So
Totally.
Yeah. Well, anyway, back over to our article. The increased number of discovered geoglyphs has really led to, literally a doubling in the number. It's led to a shift in the thinking about their meaning, suggesting they were meant to be viewed while walking and acted as a means of communication, because previously people were like, you must have to view these from the air. So how did these people, why did they create them? And there was a lot of talk about aliens and, you know, they must have made them to be viewed from the sky because people suggested that they were, you know, inscribed for the Nazca gods or for alien contact. And, you know, people have said that, but a lot of people have said as well along the way, and this is kind of leading more credence to this, that it was sort of a walking ritual. They're wide enough to walk through, like a path. And, you know, you walk the lines, you know, you walk this path and you probably get some sort of spiritual release out of it.
Not to like just jump to conclusions because we don't know how these people use them, but I can imagine that you create this image that's really only visible to the gods, right? Their gods, potentially. And then you as the human who is sort of doing whatever worship or ritual or communication with that god that you want to do, goes and walks these lines, you know, just that act of walking the line could be the connection to the god or whoever or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
I can see that being like a really super cool way to like show your devotion or I don't know, whatever. I'm using like Christianity words right now because I'm not sure what they would have called it, but you know, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think that's so cool. I love that idea. I fully support the idea of going for a Nazca line walk as a way to show my devotion to some sort of deity.
You know, we've we've kind of long-term talked about having a piece of property where we put RV spots on it. I think we should have a Nazca RV park and we make an RV.
Yes.
We make our RV area not shaped like the usual like loop or something, but shaped like Squiggly Bird, and the RVs drive down it. And but viewed from the sky, it looks like Squiggly Bird, and the RVs are parked around it. Yeah.
Okay, I love that. I think the RVers would hate you because then they'd have to drive on Squiggly Bird.
Nazca Park.
Nazca Park. Okay, let's do it. It's a deal.
All right. Well, with that, we've gone long enough. So
we did. Yep.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week. Hopefully. I don't know. It's hard to record when Rachel's not here. I don't know how the other hosts do it.
We'll make it work. We barely do it when we're together. What are you talking about?
That's what I'm talking about. All right. All right. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.